Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. We're now in the depths of winter and much of the country remains in a deep freeze. After a hot start to the year, financial markets and the news flow have also cooled off a bit, but activity could easily heat up again at any time. So this means it is a good time to reassess the investment outlook in light of market developments, economic data, and of course, policy news. Joining us for that conversation today, glad to welcome back from the UBS Chief Investment Office, Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas, Jason Draho. Jason, welcome back on this Monday morning. Great to be with you to begin another trading week. Hope you survived the storm okay, as it was quite a big event. But of course, a lot to cover on the episode today, so great to be back with you.
Good morning, Daniel. Happy Monday. Doing it remote today, because we're all a little bit snowed in. Hopefully everyone is doing well and safe. But I survived, and on to another week.
That's it. So, Jason, let's begin with the markets. Overall performance still good, but what's notable to you about what's being priced across the markets right now?
Well, a couple weeks ago, I wrote a note titled, like, starting with a bang, because the markets just, came out of the gate, so kind of, full on. I'd say things have cooled a little bit, but I think it needs to be put in perspective with the markets. For example, the S&P 500 is up, 1% year-to-date as we come getting close to the end of January. That's not a bad performance, but it was down slightly in the last 2 weeks. And even last Tuesday, it sold off a lot after some of the threats of tariffs related to Greenland. It recovered a decent amount by the end of the week. But there's a few observations I would make about the markets overall, which I think kind of puts the context as we think about where do we go from here. The first is that, there's been sort of definitely a broadening of, performance across equity markets specifically. I mentioned the 1% for the S&P 500, but if you look at the equal weight S&P 500 index, it's up 3.7%. The Russell 2000 small cap index is up 7.5%. Developed market equities, 3.5%. Emerging market equities, 7%. And we did have a stretch where, 14 days in a row, the Russell 2000 index had beat the S&P. That's up until Friday. That's the longest such streak since 1996. So definitely kind of a clear rotation of the markets and flows are following it. So it seems sort of broadening out performance. That's the first takeaway. The second is that this is kind of consistent with the run-hot narrative that investors started to embrace last fall. The idea that economic growth would kind of accelerate this year, would be strong because of policymaker support. And if you have that environment, you should get some kind of broadening that performance, relative to the Mag 7 that have been sort of dominating equity market performance for the past couple of years. And the data we've seen thus far, especially key small caps, are the best example of that, performing well, on maybe the hopes and expectations that growth will pick up. That's certainly our view. But now we will need kind of the growth data to sort of reinforce that view for this front narrative to really kind of have legs well into, the Q1, but even going into Q2. So that's the second observation. The third is on rates. If we look at yields across the Treasury curve, they're up mostly at the front of the curve, whereas the 10-year, the 30-year actually are not changed very much year-to-date. The front of the curve, rates have gone higher there because of expectations for rate cuts this year have gone lower, so as the market prices up, that impacts the 2-year more than it does the 10-year. But in some ways, the long end of the curve is really where the risks to the markets lie. If there's renewed concerns about the fiscal situation, if inflation continues to run hot, if there are just sort of overall debt sustainability questions, all that can sort of create volatility and higher back-end yields. We saw an example of that last week where the 30-year JGB, the 30-year Japanese government bond yield, was 40 basis points in 2 days to start last week. It's retraced most of that, about 75% of that. But as JGB yields go higher, and that's partly stemming from policy changes or potential policy changes there where they can run into cutting back on certain taxes, ultimately sort of trying to run their economy hot. It does spill over into the U.S. and other global bond markets. So we saw that last Tuesday, and a day that was risk-off for markets overall because of the Greenland news. Yields like the 8-year or the 10-year or the 30-year were up 8 to 10 basis points, largely because of Japan more so than anything else. So that remains sort of a story this year that pricing out cuts, but the back of the curve kind of remains a bit of a risk for the markets overall. And that feeds into the fourth observation, which is that I think that's kind of a, kind of store of value seems to be in high demand. And specifically, precious metals, gold is up 17% year-to-date, silver 50%. Just last week, gold was up 8% and silver was up around 15%. And they're almost going like vertical at this point in time. So definitely investors seeking what may perceive to be a safe haven, and certainly some momentum chasing going over there as well. So it's still very much a eventful market. A lot of interesting dynamics taking place in terms of broadening out, growth sensitivity, some long and rate risk, and then investors looking for places to store, stores of value.
Okay, so quite a few considerations there. Jason, what is driving this market performance, and what role is policy playing?
Well, I've already kind of alluded to the red and hot narrative of a kind of a cyclical growth acceleration that definitely reflected not only the broadening out of equity market performance or the demand for gold, but you're seeing your industrial metals, for example, also doing quite well in an environment where, if you have good kind of growth globally, they should benefit. So that's one factor. The other factor on policy of will you get clear policy signs of trying to run the economy hot. Japan is the most explicit because they have called a snap election, and the expectation is to consolidate power from the current ruling government, where they can sort of move forward with some of their fiscal expansion plans, which includes, for example, tax cut on or sales tax cut on food. In the U.S., I think it's likely we're going to see a policy announcement from the Trump administration, essentially maybe as soon as this week and going forward, on things that would try to spur growth, deal with affordability, put more money in the pockets of consumers, which ultimately should benefit, spending overall in the economy. And just on that point, the escalation and sort of de-escalation with tariffs on Greenland sort of consistent with that, kind of saber rattling, but ultimately not following through. In another month, I think on February 20th, that's the earliest we're going to get sort of potential news on the Supreme Court ruling on the IEEPA tariffs, if they were to rule against them. The question would be, how much does the Trump administration want to try to reinstate them or use other means to apply tariffs, knowing that affordability concerns, are a primary, kind of political consideration going into midterms, that they try to be more selective. So all these things suggest a bias towards a run and hunt narrative. So that's why I think that kind of reinforces that view. But also a lot of the policy news, whether it was Greenland last week with the tariff threats, or other policy announcements taking place, including the possibility of a government shutdown at the end of this week because they won't have passed the various appropriations bills, will create more noise, I think, for the outlook rather than really fundamentally altered overall.
So, Jason, if we spend a few moments now on the Fed, it's timely because the Fed's FOMC meeting is on Wednesday, and another cut is unlikely at this meeting. So what will you be watching for, and what is your Fed rate cut outlook from here, Jason?
Well, back at the December FOMC, during the press conference, Jay Powell kind of used language to suggest that, the committee was willing to take a pause. For example, the policy rate's in the range of neutral, that's a signaling that we think, maybe we're need to kind of reassess where policy exactly is, where the economy is. And we just do not have enough data since then that would warrant definitely another cut, given the signs of, a little bit of stabilization improvement, especially in the labor market. Other signs of the economy doing relatively well. So, unlikely to get, very, very unlikely that we get any, cut, and that would be very, very surprising to the market. There's also limited new information. The Fed doesn't update its economic forecast. There's no change in the dot plot. During the press conference, Chair Powell is likely to reiterate kind of similar message that he had back in December. He will get peppered, I'm sure, with a lot of questions regarding the Department of Justice investigation, the Supreme Court sort of, looking at the case between now it's called Dean Trump versus Cook. Lisa Cook is the governor of the Fed, and the question is, can she be removed or not? A lot of questions on those topics. I think Powell will try to parry all of them and essentially say, not commenting right now. So a relatively uneventful FOMC meeting. Our expectation right now is that the Fed will cut in March, but I think it's getting close to a toss-up. I think one more cut, if not in March, then by the spring is still likely. Beyond that, it really depends on how the economic conditions play out. And if growth accelerates as we expect, and inflation is still above 2%, from an economic perspective, it's harder to justify the Fed cutting beyond that. I think part of what the market is pricing in is that a new Fed chair will be more dovish. But I think the news to really kind of watch for in the coming days or coming weeks is almost like, who does President Trump decide to nominate as the next Fed chair? The betting markets, the prediction markets, probability of who that would be continually have shifted. And I think the two leading candidates right now, based on prediction markets of Rick Reeder and Kevin Warsh, are not particularly sort of dovish. There's not a reason to think they would then try and make a case to strongly cut rates overall. And now in terms of other, you know, kind of questions about, you know, Fed independence, the Supreme Court had a hearing or a testimony regarding the Lisa Cook case last week. And the tone of questions from most of the justices, including those who are more on the conservative side, they were raised real questions about, like, you know, the validity of the case and sort of reinforced the view that perhaps they're leaning towards favoring Fed independence. So, you know, the markets responded accordingly. So all the statistics suggest that, you know, a lot of the view that we would have for this year in terms of what is the Fed going to do, all three personnel will certainly matter, but ultimately economic conditions are probably the biggest driver. And we think it warrants probably one more cut, but not much more than that.
Okay, so that covers the Fed. We will see what happens on Wednesday. Let's turn now to the Q4 reporting season. It is underway. We have a busy week ahead of us. So, Jason, what are the notable observations from what we've seen thus far?
Well, we've had close to 15% of the S&P 100 market cap report. And we're seeing 70% of companies beating on sales estimates, 80% on earnings estimates. Those are above historical averages. And the median earnings beat is about 4.6%. That's about a percentage point higher than the historical average of 3.6%. And guidance has been, you know, fine going, you know, forward to Q1, not necessarily guiding lower. So as long as it's not going lower, that's generally a positive. Now, the market reaction to these results has been pretty muted. In fact, on average, even though it's going to be beating, you're seeing the stock price flat to slightly even down the next day. So it's, you can say this kind of good news has been largely priced in. What the companies that have reported thus far skewed heavily towards financials. This week is the real ramp-up for earnings season. It's about 35% of the S&P market cap is going to report this week, including four of these seven Mag 7 companies. So a lot of focus on what they're doing, a lot of focus on the AI theme in terms of the CapEx story. Will they continue to ramp up CapEx? What kind of monetization they're having? As a precursor to that, last week, Taiwan Semiconductor, which is, you know, the most important semiconductor manufacturer in the world, reported, and they beat and revised up their revenue guidance. You know, and that could be a potential sort of sign that, you know, you'll get a good earnings season from the Mag 7, which is notable because for a while now, your tech stocks, some of these Mag 7 companies have essentially lagged the overall market as there's been this rotation of broadening out of performance. You know, perhaps as a sign of some investor exhaustion with the theme, good results, good guidance could then get investors sort of re-engaged in terms of, you know, the outlook going forward. And we think there's probably too much maybe pessimism, you know, baked into the market. So I think there's definitely scope for upside for, you know, these 10 companies, not just to beat, but sort of reinvigorate sort of the new tech as a theme, as a driver in AI in particular.
So with that, Jason, let's end with asset allocation and the house view, which was updated just last week. What are the main investment takeaways, Jason, from the latest house view?
Sort of two kind of broad ideas. One is it's more tactical, and that, you know, we expect this, you know, broadening out of equity market performance to continue, supported by both kind of the U.S. and sort of a global economic backdrop that's likely to improve as we move forward this year. And then also as the AI innovation cycle continues to evolve, sort of broadening out from a handful of companies that have been the dominant winners to sort of a number of other companies at, you know, different layers of the AI kind of cycle to be beneficiaries. So, you know, that's kind of, that theme will continue. You know, we've liked equities globally, you know, and, you know, equities, whether it is in the Eurozone, Japan, APAC overall, China and China tech. So it's not just been the U.S., you know, story. It's not just been the U.S. tech story, but we see kind of opportunities across the board. In the U.S., we did upgrade consumer discretionary as part of that theme. As consumer discretionary should benefit from the cyclical acceleration, as well as some policy measures, you know, by the administration to try to help the affordability, help consumers. And, you know, the best way they can do it is get more money in the pockets of consumers. That's money they are likely to spend. So further broadening out of the equity rally with more upside there. But then strategically, you know, I think the lesson so far this year certainly is diversification across different regions and asset classes. You know, as the political environment shifts, as the global geopolitical environment shifts, there's more uncertainties out there, you know, perhaps a little bit more divergences in terms of market policy performance. That actually augurs well for the benefits of diversification because all markets aren't going to move in lockstep. And given all these uncertainties, that's also kind of why we like things like, the precious metals like gold, even though they've done incredibly well. And very near term, it's hard to like suggest how much higher it can go versus pull back, because it's up 17% year to date. But the direction of travel, we think, is, you know, more demand for safe assets, diversification being done by central banks and major asset allocators, and sort of the structural tail when that switches aboard to kind of gold and other precious metals going forward. And then finally on rates, I mentioned rate risk is still a concern, which is why we're a little bit cautious on extending duration. Still stick to more of that, say, 5 to 7 year part of the curve. Still lean a little more towards securitized credit, but just not taking a lot of risks overall in the fixed income space right now.
Jason, productive way to begin the week as always. Thank you for dropping by to provide our listeners, our clients, with some timely thoughts spanning the Fed to Q4 earnings and ending there on CIO's latest asset allocation recommendations and investment outlook. So I'm off to shovel more snow, but Jason, appreciate your time today and look forward to picking back up with our conversation again soon.
You're welcome, Dan. Pace yourself. It's a marathon, not a sprint when it comes to shoveling snow.
Definitely. That's great advice. Thank you, Jason. Again, today we have been joined by Jason Trejo, Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office from UBS Studios. I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.